Welcome to this edition of the Texans Talk Podcast. I'm Mark Lane, and I am joined by the general and a junior doc this podcast, as we've got John McClain, formerly of the Waco Tribune, and Dave Campbell, Texas Football, of course, from the Houston Chronicle for the past 47 years. And of course, John Crumpler, who's been doing excellent work at the Texans Wire, just absolutely belting them out of the park. You should check out his latest article, The Texans Wire 4-Round Mock. John Crumpler, how you doing tonight?
Mark, I'm doing well. You really love that phrase, belt them out.
Yeah, I do. I really do. It comes from my father, who would say that after our pastor would preach a real good sermon at church. He'd say, "Brother Herschel, man, he really belted it out today." So it's just what comes to mind with you. And John McClain, good to talk to you, sir.
Mark and John, thank you very much for having me on with you.
Thank you for coming, man. We're very excited to have you on and to talk about football. And I mean, a lot going on with the Texans and a lot going on in your life.
Yeah, so what are you up to these days since you've retired from the Chronicle?
10 weekly talk shows in 6 cities. I'm doing a lot of podcasts, TV shows, radio shows. I've always done a lot of radio shows. At one point, I was doing 16 a week in 10 cities, now 10 a week in 6 cities. And I've always loved talking about sports, especially about football. And one of the reasons I like doing radio and podcasts is because I branch out sometime, talk about some college football and Astros and baseball and college basketball. I'm a fan of a lot of sports, and I've been blessed that people have given me a platform in broadcast and print, of course, the Chronicle, for the last 47 years, 45 covering the NFL. And so I've been very busy, but and I'm going to do a little freelance for the Chronicle at the draft. And then after that, I'll see. I'd like to have one week where I didn't do anything.
So I have to ask, is your family rolling their eyes at you have the big retirement announcement. We have John McClain Day in Houston. And here you are talking sports as much as ever.
My wife left town on John McClain Day and doesn't come back until Friday. And the only one that's paying any attention is our cat, Shadow, and he yawns most of the time. I think he was a little interested in the Rockets honoring me Sunday because, like everybody, he wanted to see if I was going to embarrass myself taking a first shot for charity and shoot an air ball, which I did not. And my wife comes back in town after being gone for 2 weeks, and she may ask what's up. I don't know.
You see, that's why everybody loves John McClain right there. I mean, that's just, it's straight to the point. It's self-deprecating. We all love that kind of talk.
That's the only way I know how to be. I've always tried to be honest and accurate when reporting facts. In my opinion, people, of course, are not always going to agree with them. You know, how much fun would that be? But I want them to know it is my opinion, whether you agree with it or not. And if I screw up some facts, it's not on purpose. And if I know I do, I'll tweet I'm an idiot or I'm a moron and apologize. And I've not ever been afraid to say on the radio, I don't know, or I was wrong, or you're right. And when I'm talking to students in colleges, I tell them those three things are important for you, whether it's professionally or personally. And I told my wife, Carol, one time, I tell them that. And she says, well, you sure don't practice what you preach.
I have to imagine that journalism as a career is one of learning to laugh at yourself, because you're not going to be right all the time. And John, I got to ask you, you had a tweet about a year ago that said you would be head coach of the Houston Texans before Deshaun Watson was traded. And a year later, Watson is traded. And this is a twofold question. One, do you laugh at that tweet? Is it pretty funny looking back how much has changed? And then you're still pretty connected with the Texans organization. What's the vibe around the team right now that burden's sort of been lifted off of them?
I'm still covering the Texans because I got to talk about them 4 days a week here in Houston on Sports Radio 610. And at least I didn't have to eat the sports section on that prediction. But what little people don't know this, and I'm going to give you guys a scoop. It wasn't Lovie Smith they turned to when they wisely decided to not hire Josh McCown. They called me and said, would you like to coach the team? And I'm thinking, okay, I could coach the team. Watson hasn't been traded, and my prediction would come true. But I thought, nah, I'll let Lovie do it.
That's very generous of you.
Yeah, definitely. It was very generous. But what does the building feel like post-Watson trade, though?
Well, first of all, everything was in turmoil when they were going to hire Josh McCown. And they were hiring Josh McCown. They were ready to announce it, even though they're never going to admit that. And Brian Flores attaching them to the lawsuit saying that he didn't get hired because of his lawsuit. No, he didn't get hired because they were going to hire Josh McCown. And then they came to the senses because of the lawsuit. And they took a step back and saying, no, wait a minute. You know, we're going to hire a guy with no experience at all except in high school. And that was being pushed, masterminded by Jack Easterby, their executive VP of football ops, who as interim general manager in 2020 brought McCown in on the roster. Those guys knew each other before in some kind of ministry or FCA. And I'll guarantee you, Easterby had a grand plan to hire him. I had two prominent players tell me after that season, you watch, Jack Easterby is going to do everything he can to get Josh McCown hired as a head coach. And I'm thinking, yeah, okay. I've heard nothing but great things about McCown. Come in as assistant quarterback coach, then work his way up to quarterback coach and then offensive coordinator. And then if things go well, you make him this head coach. And they're like, uh-uh. He wants him to be head coach with no experience. And that's exactly what happened. And McCown's very, very impressed. He makes a great impression. Everybody likes and respects him. And a lot of the teams that he's with, I've talked to people. They said, this guy's going to be a really good coach when he decides that's what he wants to do. And I thought he might be on Lovie Smith's staff. Lovie's had him two places, Chicago and Tampa, loves the guy. But I would imagine people say, well, what happened to McCown? I said, when you yank the rug out from under somebody, I don't think he's going to follow that rug and come to work for the company that did it. So who knows where he'll be in the future. So once they named Lovie, he brought a calmness to the organization where they'd been in turmoil. Everybody over there is like, what? What? We're going to do what? I said, yep, you're hiring Josh McCown. And so Lovie, I compared to like you're on a ship or a boat or a yacht, whatever. It's turbulent water. And then all of a sudden the guy, the captain can't handle the wheel. And then Lovie steps up there and puts his hand on it and steadies. And then once Lovie had that initial news conference and a lot of ex-players came in like Andre Johnson, listened to him, praise the heck out of him in the media, then all of a sudden, everybody, okay, I can see this. Now, I don't know how long Lovie Smith's going to be there. I'll guarantee he's not going to be a one and done like David Culley. And I think they're undergoing phase two of the rebuilding process. So they're not going to jump up and win 7 or 8 games all of a sudden. I think they'll be competitive in 2023 if Davis Mills improves the way Pep Hamilton and Lovie Smith expect him to. But things are so much better over there. There's organization. They're not pulling in different directions, which they did under Bill O'Brien. Jack Easterby seems to have faded into the background, or maybe he's pushed into the background. And so they're in really good shape going into this draft. 5 picks among the first 80, then 2 in the fourth round, 11 overall. And Nick Caserio is going to do a lot of wheeling and dealing. People are pumped about having a first-round pick for the first time since 2019, and everybody in that organization is excited about this draft, just like fans and media. I know it's going to be so much more fun to cover this one than it was last season when you didn't even have picks in the first 2 rounds.
Yeah, and also just in terms of Houston having twin first-round picks, that's something that's not happened since 2004. So even when you've had the lean and kind of rebuilding years of 05, 06, after, you know, when Kubiak took over, and even when he left in 13, you know, this, you've got two first-round picks. It just seems like there's a lot of optimism of what could happen.
I think when we look back on Caserio's first draft, he had five players. They all showed promise. Garrett Wallow, linebacker, was last to get a chance to play. Now, it doesn't mean any of them are going to be real good players. It just means they showed promise, starting with Davis Mills. And the one that started the most was the last pick, Roy Lopez, on the nose. So based on what we saw from the staff, I mean, from the picks last year, it gives people extra hope that Caserio's going to get some guys again, and they'll be able to contribute backup roles, special teams, their starting jobs available if they can play well enough to get them. And one of the things I'm sure he's going to do, he's not going to say he trades down with it from the third spot and picks up a couple more picks. He doesn't want 13 rookies on the team next year. He's looking for more picks in 2023 and 2024. He's got a bunch next year too, but I could see him making deals ahead. Next year, he's going to have $120 million under the cap, something like that. By far the most they've ever had. And they'll be ready to be competitive in 23. So instead of signing all these guys to not much money for 1 and 2 year deals, I think we'll see him making a splash on a couple of big free agents that they think will help them get over the hump and be a wild card contender, not a division title contender, but a wild card contender. And when I say that on Sports Radio 610, they laugh at me. You actually think this team could be a wild card contender in 2023? I said I do if Davis Mills improves the way they think, and Caserio drafts well, and he's going to have a lot of money for veteran free agents. And to be a contender, all you got to do is win 9 games. And this year, if you think about this past season, 4 victories. Davis Mills played great against the Patriots, best any rookie's ever played against Bill Belichick based on the rating, and they lost by 3. Last game of the year, he played great against the Titans. They had to win to secure home field advantage. They won by 3. So in the game at Miami, they lost by 1 score, and they were blown out of some games, and they should have been. They were terrible, and they're playing a rookie quarterback way before they wanted to, but you know, they were competitive in some of those games. So I could see this team winning 6 or 7 games next season. And then the season afterward, you know, look to win 8, 9, maybe even 10 if the progress is what they hope it is.
John, I agree with you on that. I think there's an avenue for this team to improve pretty quickly. We definitely want to talk about those two first-round picks. We want to talk about the cap space. But I had a question for you, if I can circle back to the coaching search. When I was in Mobile for the Senior Bowl, and I was told while I was there that they were actively negotiating with Jonathan Gannon. Is there any truth to that? How far did they get with
Gannon? No, absolutely. Absolutely not. There's so much bad information out there in the media today. You know, there's no accountability. You throw it on the wall every once in a while, it sticks. Could be this, maybe that. No. Jonathan Gannon got 2 interviews, and they were going to hire Josh McCown. I wrote that way back while all this was going, and they denied it, and they still deny it. And I know it's true, and they know it's true, and they better be glad they're not Pinocchio, because their noses would be growing across NRG Stadium. And, but Gannon, you know, they liked him when he came in. He had a good interview. Brian Flores had a good interview, and he should have, because Nick Caserio's known him ever since he came into the NFL. And Lovey was right there. And one of the things they use Lovey for as associate head coach, he's got a lot of contacts in the NFL. So they had him working on a search with him, checking some people out through his contacts. And I equated what happened with Lovey to a romantic comedy where, say, Jennifer Aniston is the female star, and she, her good buddy, her best friend she works with, is trying to help her with men or she's trying to help him with women, and they both bomb out, and then all of a sudden they're, whoa, we were made for each other. And then they fall in love into the movie. Yeah. And so Lovey's right there, and they're like, well, you know, why don't, wow, Lovey's got experience, Lovey's got this. What about Lovey? Well, let's see if he wants to interview. Well, of course he did. He wanted to be a head coach again. I asked him that in his first news conference. He told me later, he said, what'd you expect me to say? I said, nothing. I just wanted to see how you were going to squirm. And so I knew he wanted it, but he's not the kind to actively pursue it. Mm-hmm. And from what I understand, they talked to him about that on a Saturday. They started talking to him in earnest on Sunday. They had an official interview Monday morning. They announced it on Monday afternoon, introduced him on Tuesday. And I think people that were at his news conference or read the transcripts or heard it could see he's an impressive guy. And he should be. He's had a lot of experience doing this. You know, he was with the Chicago media for 9 years. And then, of course, Tampa for two. And so he's a smooth operator. He's a first-class guy, very low-key, very intense when he coaches. But he is a very low-key. And I think that's what they need right now. They don't need a screaming, raving lunatic like Bill O'Brien.
Yeah, no, I never realized how much of the Lovie Smith coaching search was akin to the plot of 27 Dresses. And also how it moved quickly, kind of like the song 7 Days by Craig David. That's very interesting, John.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happened. And Lovey was right there under their noses. I think when they started interviewing those people, originally Flores was the first one they interviewed. And I thought, well, okay, Caserio, he wants to hire his buddy from New England. And then Flores, after throwing Bill Belichick under the bus, he's done that to Caserio too, two guys he worked with forever, by attaching the Texans to his lawsuit. And I thought early on, because of his experience and because of what I thought was a really good relationship with Caserio, that he would get the job and he'd get it pretty fast. But of course he didn't. And then here comes Easterby pushing Josh McCown, which I think he'd been doing quite a while. And I know McCown came in for two interviews, but I'm so happy they elevated Lovey. I've known him since he was coaching DBs for Tony Dungy, and I spent a lot of time in Tampa while I covered the NFL, and Tony turned around that franchise. It was a great story for not just Tampa, but the NFL, and Tony was great with the media. I could go in Tony's office, talk to him. I could go in Lovey's office, Herm Edwards' office, any of them. You try to do that today, they would taser you.
Yeah, and Lovey's the exact kind of coach they needed. He brings a lot of respect league-wide. For a Houston franchise that's caught a lot of heat, he's stabilized things. Like you said, he's stilled the waters, and he's Caserio's guy now. This is his second hire in 2 years, and he cannot be a one-and-done. And I want to transition to the third overall pick. There's a lot of guys up for debate right now. The conversation primarily centers around Kayvon Thibodeau, Sauce Gardner, and Akeem Okwonu. Where do you think Houston might be leaning with that first pick? And do you think Caserio is going to go get a blue chip defensive prospect for Lovey's defense? Or do you think they try to help Davis Mills?
John, let's look at each of those guys individually. If you're going to draft a corner that high, you better play man coverage, because he's going to have to, with that kind of where he's drafted, rare to draft a corner that high. But if you're going to do it, you better run a man scheme where he's going to cover the opponent's best receiver all over the field. They don't do that. They play a lot of zone. They need corners, but they've got depth at corner. They don't need to do that. Now, if they traded down, say, with Carolina, and Carolina wanted to draft Blake Willis, and then they've got so many needs, but the primary needs, because the running game was the worst in the NFL, the worst in team history, they have to fix the running game. And Marlon Mack isn't the answer. They've got to get a premier running back like Breece Hall or Kenneth Walker in the second round. So in the first round, say they take Ike Kwanu, and Ike's going to play guard for a year, and he is the meanest, nastiest, butt-kicking player in the draft. And they need that in the interior. And now, if they wanted to play him outside and move Tyus Howard back to guard, which I think was a huge mistake last year, but You know, Laremy Tunsil is not a great run blocker. He's a great pass protector. And Titus is not great at run blocking or pass protecting. He's good, and he's got a chance to be better. And they need to stock the line. I read a column, and I can't remember who wrote it, about it's be a mistake for them to do that, the offensive line. And if I'd have been a smart ass, I would have said, yeah, like it was a mistake to draft Mike Munchak, Bruce Matthews back-to-back, Dean Steinkuhler the next year before you started, Ray Childress, Haywood Jeffries. That worked out pretty well, drafting those linemen to beef up the running game. And the reason is, as you guys know, if you've got a good ball control running game, you keep the defense on the bench. There's nothing Sauce Gardner can do for this offense. There's nothing a pass rusher can do unless he's forcing fumbles to shorten the field for the offense. There's nothing Kyle Hamilton can do for the offense. But that offense can do a lot for those defensive players. And Evan Neal, you know, he's a tackle prospect who started guard. Those guys can play guard or tackle. Tunsil played guard as rookie before they moved him to tackle. So I wish they would use it on an offensive lineman or if they trade down. Now, Kayvon Thibodeau, I have listened and read so many people, former general managers, personnel people that ran drafts, and they all say Thibodeau does tick off plays. Now, if you got the third pick, you cannot afford to take a guy who takes off plays. Thibodeau may end up in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, but you just can't afford to do that. You got to do a sure thing. If it doesn't work out, and a lot of them don't, but if it doesn't, at least you took the guy that you thought was the best prospect who fit what you wanted and gave 100% effort on every play. Now, Trayvon Walker, his stock's gone up so much in shorts and T-shirts, it's amazing. And I every year I think about that. Mario Williams, Texans didn't even go to his pro day. And he blows everybody away at the combine, and they're going to draft Reggie Bush. And all of a sudden, they force themselves, falling in love with Mario, going over there after the combine. They didn't go to his pro day, but, whoa, we got to do a private workout. And they talked themselves into taking him, and that was the right pick over Reggie Bush and Vince Young. And then with Jevion Clowney, you know, they were going to take him all along. And I have no qualms about that because there's no quarterbacks either one of those years that panned out. But in Clowney, I do think if he had not had such serious knee injuries, which he bounced back from, I think he would have been a little better pass rusher. You know, he still never had double-digit sacks, but based on what he had microfracture surgery, he had four other surgeries. I think if he hadn't had those issues, you'd see him instead of getting 9, he might get 10, 11, 12. But Walker, everybody loves Walker, but, man, they weren't talking about him like that when Georgia won a national championship. Like Jordan Davis, nobody went crazy about him until he worked out well at the combine. He didn't play but 5% of the pass rush snaps. And so you take a guy, they're not going to take him third overall, but some people are saying 13, and he would be great in the middle, but they like Roy Lopez. But they may do that somewhere. But at number three, I think if Walker's there, they would take him. If Thibodeau's there, buyer, he's got to come with a sign that says buyer, beware. And I still think there's a good chance he'll trade down if indeed somebody wants to trade up for Malik Willis. They need Detroit. All of a sudden, some mocks are having him going to Detroit. And I'm thinking, my goodness, they had every film of every pass he threw, and everybody's talking about, oh, he needs a year, mediocre crop of quarterbacks, nobody's going high. Now a lot of people are talking about him going a second overall because, man, he threw some great passes at the combine, threw some great passes as a pro day. And, oh, yeah, nobody's rushing him. He wasn't wearing a uniform. Nobody's covering his receivers. But anyway, I think it'll be an offensive lineman or a pass rusher at three. If they trade it down some, it might be Sauce Gardner or Kyle Hamilton.
So if they do go with an offensive lineman, what do you think they do with Titus Howard? They're going to kick him back into guard?
I sure hope not. I hope George Warhop, the new line coach, the third one in 3 years, watched that tape last year, how much better Titus played at tackle than he played at guard. Titus is going into his fourth year. You know, we're talking about fifth-year option that I think they'll pick up. And to run the ball better, they got to get
the rookie
tougher in the middle.
Have them play guard, whether it's Aquanu or Neal.
I think if you take Aquanu, I don't know about Neal. Neal started 1 year at guard, and then he started both tackles the last 2 years. I would take Aquanu over Neal. He's not as accomplished as a pass protector, but everybody says he will be, but you've got to get tougher on the interior. And to do that, you got to get a guy who's one mean SOB, and he is. And he's got to help, along with A.J. Cann, who'll be the right guard, assuming he's 100% recovered from his surgery on medial collateral ligament. Those guys got to help transform this running game. If you want Davis Mills to show the kind of improvement that you expect, you can't saddle him with a god-awful running game for the third year in a row. It's just inexcusable. And I wrote twice, I think, that Nick Caserio would be derelict in his duties if he doesn't help this running game make significant improvements.
Yeah, so I've seen in mock drafts, for example, just today on Wednesday, Roy Orbison from ESPN, Mel Kiper, had, again, Charles Cross going to the Texans. To me, it seems like he's just a tackle and you have to kick in Titus Howard. You think Houston would do something like that, take Cross? I think they would avoid Charles Cross, honestly.
Mel Kiper has the Texans taking Charles Cross third overall.
13th.
But nevertheless, acquiring him.
Okay.
And thus, what do you do with Titus Howard? You have to kick him inside at that point.
Well, first of all, Gil Brandt, who I have great respect for as a personnel evaluator, I heard him a couple of weeks ago saying that Charles Cross, when he played a few years, people are going to start talking about him for the Hall of Fame. And I'm like, whoa. And he just praised the heck out of Cross. And then I see others, well, he played in the kind of offense that's going to take him a time to adjust to the NFL. So I don't know. He's talented. And I do believe this. If they take a defensive player with their first pick, that they'll take an offensive lineman with their second pick, no matter who it is. The key is to get good players in there and worry about where they're going to play later. And if they move Titus back inside because they could get Cross in at right tackle, then fine. But you just have to get better. You don't have to have the Munchak Matthews and Dean Steinkuhler starting in your offensive line, but you have to get players who come in with the kind of mentality you need to improve the running game that has been non-existent for the last two seasons.
And they're lucky that this is a really deep draft in the trenches, especially at that offensive guard spot, which creates a bit of a dilemma at spending that premium draft capital. What are some of the edge rushers to pivot that you like at 13? Are you a Jermaine Johnson fan? I mocked him to Houston today at 13, got to watch him at the Senior Bowl. What are you hearing about Johnson?
If Aiden Hutchinson is gone before they pick at 3, and if he weren't, I think they would take him. But if Trayvon Walker's gone, if it came down to Kayvon Thibodeau and Jermaine Johnson, I'm putting him with Jermaine Johnson, lining him up opposite of Jonathan Grenard with Malik Collins and Roy Lopez. That's the four I'm going with. And, of course, they need depth. They'll draft with 11 picks, or even if they end up with 8 or 9, I think they'll draft 2 pass rushers. They need 3. Ross Blacklock, huge disappointment first 2 seasons. You get drafted in the second round, you think you're going to be playing more, at least in your second season. But he's now a backup tackle who plays in some passing situations. And a good thing about the Texans, the positions that they need have depth. There's depth at safety, depth at corner, depth in the offensive line, depth at edge rusher. And so they really can't go wrong as far as need. I see people having them take a receiver in the first round. Give me a break. Don't you know anything about this team? I can't say who this is because he's a friend of mine. And he's been in the league. He was in the league 13 years. And I heard him make a prediction on national radio, a mock draft about weekend before last. When it came to third with the Texans, he picked them taking a quarterback. And I'm like, oh, gosh. And then that quarterback, Sam Howell. And I'm like, you have no credibility. And it's pretty obvious he hadn't studied the draft. But I don't see him taking a receiver in the first round. I don't see – there's a lot of position. I don't see him taking a quarterback. They could take a corner – a corner like Gardner, maybe Stingley, maybe Kyle Hamilton, the safety, who a lot of people have rated in their top three. The good thing is, no matter who it is, he should be able to help them as a rookie. And that third pick better start from day one.
Well, you know, I mean, mocking Sam Howell in the first round to Houston would be totally reasonable if you were in a coma the last 6 months. I mean, this was a number one. I was in conversation for the number one pick before the college football season. So this is a big draft. This is when we're going to start to define Caserio. But you touched on this earlier. They have over $100 million in cap space. What kind of spender do you think we're going to see Nick operate as, both in starting to extend his own guys in the next year and next offseason?
I love the fact you extend your own people because that sends a message. If you come in here and you help contribute to the culture's attitude. That's what culture is. People wonder, well, what's the culture they're talking about? It's attitude, to do things the way the head coach and the general manager want done. And one of the reasons they got rid of Bradley Roby last year, he didn't get with the programs. A couple others that they did, they're late. You know, Zach Cunningham. Zach, he didn't show up for a COVID test. So David Culley said, that's not what everybody else does it. We just can't do it. So they cut him. He goes to Tennessee, and he's in the playoffs, and more power to him. But when you're bad and you're trying to build, you need players to believe. And Pep Hamilton believes. He had five teams interested in him. He could have left as a coordinator, but he wanted to work here. He wanted to work with Lovie. He also really likes Davis Mills. And he's got a son that's going to be a really good player in high school here, and I think they like to – high school football in Texas, which they should. So he could have gone. Malik Collins, I believe, could have gone somewhere else. But a lot of the players believe in Lovie. And next year, when they have a lot of money, it depends on what the needs are, who's available. But I could see not some outrageous contract, say, for $230 million guaranteed. They're not going to do something that's stupid. But I do see them spending money on a couple of free agents. Say they still need a pass rusher, and there's one out there. So they still need an offensive lineman. Perish the thought. Somebody like that. Or there's a good receiver out there. I could see Nick Caserio not paying break-the-bank money, but paying big money to bring in those type players, but making sure the guys they want to take care of are taken care of.
And what I think that everybody's looking forward to that 23 offseason, because as you said, that's when they'll be able to assemble that talent and finally get competitive, where you can contend for a playoff spot. Hey, especially since they've added the 7th equal attention birthday cake playoff spot, you'd figure Houston should be able to get after that, even with all of the additions Caserio makes in 23 when he has that cap space.
John, and he's got more picks. Hang on 1 second, John. I'm sorry. And he's still got 2 number one picks, and he's got – I think right now he has 11 picks next year, and he might have traded one of those lower ones, but he's got a lot again. And I think next year he will have more because of trades this year. And then in next year's draft, he'll make deals for picks in 2024 because this is a multi-year process for the rebuild, and they're realistic about that. And I think the fans and media understand it. And whether or not they're competitive in 2023 depends greatly on Davis Mills. On those last four games last season, he played really well. I wrote a column about 2 weeks before I retired from the Chronicle. He was the best rookie quarterback in the league over the last month, far better than Mac Jones. They caught up with Mac Jones. His record was just as good. And for the season, of course, Mac Jones was the best, and he was number two. And I saw a graphic where one of the national, might have been NFL, might have been ESPN, showing which one of these rookie quarterbacks from this season will have a breakout year in 2022. And he wasn't included. And I'm like, how can you not include the guy that was clearly the second best rookie quarterback, despite not having a running game and a terrible defense? And Mac Jones had both of those. He had a good running game and a good defense. You put him with that group of players they had last year and put Davis Mills up there, no telling what he'd been able to do down the stretch. Now, he wasn't ready to play early because he only started 11 games at Stanford. But I think if he makes progress, then people, that's how you get people fired up, is you know you got a quarterback. And if he doesn't, they got the ammunition to trade up, try to get Bryce Young or C.J. Stroud. Both of them, if they come out early, as everybody believes they will make that an outstanding quarterback class. I'm sorry, John, go ahead.
So, no, it's fine. That actually flows pretty well. The Texans are betting a lot on the development of Davis Mills, and it looks like they might have hit a home run in the third round. And the other thing that they're really betting on, and you talked about this, guys who fit with their program, this idea of the culture. You said Bradley Roby and Zach Cunningham, they really couldn't buy in and they were out. Do you think that concerns about how an overcommitment to culture could be counterproductive to winning, do you think that's fair? Do you think that's overblown? Because when you talk about the Houston Texans right now, there is a lot of discussion. It's hard not to talk about the culture. So what are your thoughts on that?
I think people are clueless about what culture means. They make fun of the Texans talking about it. And all culture is attitude. You can ask anybody that's been in the NFL, they'll tell you culture means attitude. Is there something wrong with having the right kind of attitude to try to win? Whether it's being on time, going to meetings, paying attention, practicing hard. Those are all things the best teams do. And if you got people that don't do it and they're great players, you'll cut them some slack. They didn't have guys that are great players doing it. And so I think it's imperative any team trying to rebuild has to build the attitude. You can't have five guys pulling one way and two pulling another way. And but if you guys got guys like DeAndre Hopkins, who never practiced, Jadeveon Clowney, who was kind of a clown a lot of times, everybody liked him, a big kid. That doesn't bother some people, but boy, because they played. But it bothered Bill O'Brien. They wouldn't get with the program the way he wanted it. And so that's why they were traded. And Hopkins, of course, will go down as one of the worst trades in history. And you have to cut great players slack, productive players slack. But they were already in the playoffs and competing for the Super Bowl. So it was easier, should have been easier to do that.
And that's the thing, is great coaches recognize that you've got gamers, and great players, they get some latitude. And it just seemed like Bill O'Brien wanted to run the Texans like a college.
He wanted to run it the way he wanted it. Bill was a disciplinarian. He was all business. Everything had to be a certain way. He made everybody walk around on pins and needles, eggshells at the end. And when they were winning and winning the division, people would listen to Bill. And then when they didn't, they let it go in one ear and out the other. He didn't adjust. The pressure made him even worse to deal with, made everybody unhappy to come to work. Bob McNair told me early on, Bob McNair said he wanted everybody, And that was on the football side and the administrative side, to be excited to come to work every day. He wanted them to be fired up because everybody was on the same page. They were all had the same goal of doing everything they could in their department to try to help the team win, to try to help the team do things in the community, to do business the way it should be done. And they had that a lot. When Gary Kubiak was there, Dom Capers was there, that's the way it was. And then when Bill came in, the first year they go from 2-14 to 9-7, didn't make the playoffs. And then people say, okay, Bill O'Brien knows what he's doing. And then next year they won the division in 15, won the playoffs 16. And then the tougher Bill got, people, him blowing up at people, blowing his stack, people accepted it and dealt with it. But then when you're losing and you make it worse and people dread being around you, that is not the kind of attitude you want on your team. Bill O'Brien didn't get fired because he was 0-4. He got fired because everybody over there was miserable. And his good buddy, Jack Easterby, turned on him and ended up getting rid of him, of course, and being the interim general manager.
Yeah, I remember that Cal McNair had an interview with Mark Vandermeer, and he probably echoed the same thing to you when you talked to him after Bill O'Brien got fired. He said he wanted to see the team having fun again. He wanted to see the Rock Boys again. He just wanted to see NRG Stadium just have fun again.
When J.J. Watt blows up on the field at O'Brien because O'Brien was mad at the defense and told him to get their you-know-what off the field, and Watt said, no, we're going to do it till we get it right. And then when Bill was fired, J.J. put out a text with the roof open showing sunlight on the field. Sunshine was back. And I asked him about it in a Zoom, and he almost didn't answer it. And I was going to say, hey, you posted it, not me. But then he gave an answer without, you know, telling exactly what he felt. But that's the way everybody felt. And especially with Romeo taking over, because Romeo is one of the all-time great guys. Everybody loved Romeo Crennel. So right now with Lovie Smith and Nick Caserio, people over there are starting to believe. They believe that they can turn around this team. And the key is, of course, they got to make sure they do well with this draft. Not all the players are going to be real good. In fact, if they could hit on one of the two first-round picks, that'd be pretty good. Ultimately, I'm talking about second contracts. But this draft is so important to prove to people that we are going to be better and we do know what we're doing.
Yeah, and for 22, they're investing, well, you know, counting on Davis Mills. They're allowing him to prove it. But separate from win total, what does he have to prove to fend off future challengers?
I think that the win total is not going to be as important as his performance. Davis Mills needs to show progress. He needs to be better at throwing the ball down the field. Receivers have a lot to do that. He has a new play caller in Pep Hamilton. Tim Kelly, of course, is in Tennessee. He needs balance. He needs a running game that's going to help him. He needs defenses to think when he takes the snap that they might actually run the ball. Instead of the defense laughing at the possibility of running the ball, they actually, whoa, we got to pay attention to this. They need to have a running game that makes the play action game working. And I think they like how smart he is. They like the way he learns. They like the way he bounces back from bad performances like the Buffalo game where he threw four interceptions, was just terrible. A practice and training camp, threw five interceptions, got ripped by everybody, came back the next day and looked good. They liked that about him. We knew he was smart. And they also liked the way his teammates gravitate to him. So that shows the kind of leadership. So they like everything about him. But next season, he doesn't have the excuse of only starting 11 games in college, and they expect him to take command of the offense.
Okay, so that's it. They want to see him take command of the offense and just, but I mean, that's kind of tracks with how the last five games went, because you had Justin Britt talk about this week that Mills, his calmness and his cool demeanor just really resonated in those final five games compared to that disastrous six-game losing streak to start his career.
I remember when David Culley brought back Tyrod Taylor, a lot of people said, oh, Caserio did it. No, he didn't do it. Culley made those decisions in his contract. And so he brought him back as the starter. And I remember telling Culley, I'll bet you that Mills getting a different perspective now. Now that he has a feel for what's happening on the field, he'll be able to watch and learn. And when he gets another chance to play, and I didn't know it would be as soon as it was, because I thought Tyrod come back and play the way he did early in the year, but he didn't. And so when Mills came back in, he was a different quarterback mentally. That's what happens when you're a rookie. And if they give, he needs one more receiver. You know, they brought back all these tight ends. They still don't have a good tight end. Bevin Jordan may be a good receiver, but he's more like an H-back. But if you want a guy to throw the ball better and you want him to throw it downfield better, and they want to make sure he has at least 2-to-1 touchdown to interception ratio, 3-to-1 being better, you got to put weapons around him. And the head coach, considering he's a defensive coordinator calling defense, you know, he's going to be in one ear at Caserio. Pep Hamilton's going to be in the other. They're going to be whispering what they want. And they should both come out of this draft pretty happy.
Yeah, and that's what Texans fans are looking for, is to just continue to have a great feeling about the draft, because it's generating so much optimism. And everyone knows that you've retired from the Houston Chronicle after 47 years at that paper, which, by the way, folks, that is incredible, because in the journalism business, usually there's mergers and acquisitions and layoffs and all this. And he stayed there for nearly 50 years. It's just, it really is remarkable. But that job afforded you the opportunity to cover NFL games. And even when there was no NFL team from 97 to 01, and you were covering every, an NFL, different NFL game every week, you got to travel to a lot of places. So I'm curious, what were some of your favorite restaurants or sites to see for NFC or uncommon AFC road games?
Well, I'll tell you this, as I've told everybody, because the two places, if you're a football fan, you have to go, Canton, Ohio, to the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Lambeau Field, you know, the cathedral. My first time at Lambeau was 1980. I've probably been there 25 or 30 times because I covered a lot of playoff games. And I'll never forget, they had a preseason game. It was at night. And after I finished writing, I had to go down into the stands with my good friend Brett Coomer, our photographer, and we had to record a segment for the Chronicle Sunday night show on KPRC. And Brett says, well, since you're retiring, why don't I take a couple pictures here and you in a vacant Lambeau Field? And most of the time, I do not like pictures made of me. I got a body and a face for radio, but I liked it. And it was really cool to be in Lambeau. It's like I was the only person there. And then Brad said, since you're retiring, why don't we go to Cleveland a day early and go down to the Hall of Fame and take pictures of you around the Hall of Fame? I said, okay. So I called a friend of mine there, told him what we were doing. And it was so funny where he wanted a picture of me in front of the bust of every Oiler I have presented who made the Hall of Fame. And it was crowded. So we'd have to let people get by. Brett had lights. You know, he's Spielberg. He had to have everything perfect. And two times I'm standing in front of a bust, and a woman would come up, and she'd look at the bust and look at me and go, congratulations. And it was obvious she thought I was having my picture made in front of my bust. And I want to say, yeah, I gained a little weight since those days. So I just thanked them very much, and we took some pictures inside and out. And so I love those two places. And when I was doing NFL for those 8 years, I didn't start on the Texans till 05 because I didn't want to cover a loser. And so I went to I love Tampa. Great story. Tony Dungy's turnaround. Went to New England a lot because I love Boston and Maine and New England, eating lobster and chowder on the water. And so I spent a lot of time when that dynasty started and went up there. And then I love any teams that I covered as much as I could on the West Coast. Denver, I used to, my wife and I would ski a lot, and we'd go up there, and I would write. And then on Friday night, we'd go up into the mountains, ski on Saturday, come back on Sunday. So I've been blessed. I've been to Tokyo, Mexico City, London, El Paso. I used to tell the NFL, when you schedule the game in Germany or China, you should put the Texans in there. Do not forget that the Oilers set the all-time attendance record at Mexico City, El Paso, and Tokyo. And one of the guys in the league office said, really? The Oilers were that popular? I said, yeah, they played the Cowboys, but that's beside the point.
Yeah, right. Well, you missed out on a chance on that because originally they were going to have a preseason game in 07, the China Bowl, featuring the New England Patriots, but they had to cancel it. But so you missed out on that one.
I had just come back from Hong Kong and wanted to go back. And that one I had to pay for it. I wanted to go back on the Chronicle expense. And when they pulled the plug on that one, I knew that the Texans were never going to have a chance. Getting the Chronicle, reason I stayed the Chronicle so long is I got treated great. I had 10 sports editors. Reed LaMance is executive sports editor right now. My sports editors treated me like royalty. And how many guys have bosses like that? They paid me well. They only one time did they ever question an expense. And that was because the managing editor at the time knew I took my girlfriend and spent too much money in San Francisco on meals. And but that was the only time in all those years I covered, you know, over 40 Super Bowls. I covered probably 20 Pro Bowls. And I spent a lot of money, wrote a lot. And what better job? Go where you want, write as much as you want, spend as much as you want. And one of the things I liked, I would go to games like 5 hours early, and so I could get in the press box, and you could run into executives, and that early before games, say 4 hours, they hadn't started to get uptight. So I got to meet general managers, and I'd meet coaches during the week. And I'll never forget this. I think it was 97. Packers were going to the Super Bowl, and I was in Ron Wolf's office in Green Bay doing a story, multiple stories on the Packers in Titletown, and T.J. Simers of the L.A. Times was with me, and Ron Wolf asked us if we wanted to go to lunch with him, and we're, yeah, and he says, this might be the last time I get to do something like this. I said, why? He said, well, my PR guy, Jeff Blum, tells me there's a new thing called the internet, and a lot of people are going to be writing and broadcasting about the NFL who are not professionals like you guys, and so I'm going to have to cut back on what I say and do off the record because it could be bad for our organization. And I'm thinking, give me a break. That's never going to happen.
Well, I guess, you know, that was just another one of those times that you were wrong then. But it's really been great to have you here on the Texans Talk podcast, John. And I just want to I've never told you this before, and I'll tell you now. It shouldn't embarrass you too much. But I really consider the first time that I met you at the NFL owners meetings at the Biltmore Hotel in Phoenix in 2017 to be really one of the kind of like resuscitations of my career, because at that particular point, people were trying to throw dirt on my grave, and my career was kind of at the continue screen of, you know, game over. And, you know, you introduced me to the late Bob McNair, to Amy Palsik, and I remember you told me, you said that, you know, you really need to stop being bashful, but you just really gave me the attention and encouragement and introductions that I needed to keep this thing going. And I really owe my success to you in terms of you just really giving me that chance. And I really appreciate it. And so for those listening, if you are in a position of influence as John's been, don't be afraid to use it, because you don't know how much it'll mean to someone. And if you're someone that's discouraged and still battling and just looking for that hand up, it's out there. Keep going. Keep pressing. The hand will come. So that's what I've got to say, John.
Well, Mark, that's very nice of you to say. I remember you were wandering the halls of the Biltmore looking like a lost puppy, and I went up and introduced myself to see if I could help you at the combine. When I see somebody who looks new walk into the media room and looking around, usually somebody young, I'll go up and introduce myself and say, "Can I help you? What do you need?" And because I didn't have anybody do that for me, and I said, I'm never going to not help people if they want to be helped. There have been people I've gone up to say, "Hey, how are you? Can I help you?" "Nope, I'm good." And I'll say, "Fine, if I help you, let me know." But that's very nice of you to say, Mark. And I do remember us going, wandering around the big ESPN party out in the middle of the Biltmore. That is always a fun experience to go to the league meetings. And I'm glad everything's worked out well for you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, John. I really appreciate it. By the way, who at the combine transcribed the most transcripts?
Let's see. That would be Mark Lane. You ever heard of him?
Yeah, I think he was a JFK conspiracy theorist from Dallas. He wrote...
yeah, you did a great job.
Rush to Judgment.
Great job.
Yeah, and you've done...
And we always appreciate you doing that.
Hey, I'm going to get up there in 23 in Indianapolis, or wherever they're going to have the combine, and crank out those transcripts. But we really appreciate you coming on the Texans Talk podcast. It was great. John Crumpler, final words.
Yeah, John, thank you. Thank you again so much for coming on. Great having you here. I've not gotten to meet you personally, but you've done so much for this industry. Final words. Two more weeks, guys. We're getting towards the draft.
John and Mark, thank you guys for having me, and it's the best time of the off season. Thank you.
Have a great morning, everybody.